Okay. To stay somewhat back on schedule, our next talk is Internet Fantasy and Prediction by Dr. Elliot Atkins, who's in private clinical, forensic, and consulting practice in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Internet Fantasy and Prediction. Oh, and Dr. White, John H. White, Ph.D., began his career as a fingerprint technician with the Federal Bureau of Investigation before continuing his law enforcement endeavors as an investigator sergeant for the Dallas, Texas Police Department, where he's also worked in the Psychological Services Office. After receiving a Ph.D. From the University of North Texas, Dr. White began teaching at the Richmond Stockton College of New Jersey. He's a licensed forensic psychologist in New Jersey, where he specializes in the evaluation and treatment of sex offenders, including those who commit internet crimes and sexual homicide. Drs. Atkins and White.
Thank you. The most challenging part of this conference for me, I hope, is over. Have any of you come by way of American Airlines? I came from Philadelphia, and they canceled my first flight, which was to come through Dallas out to San Francisco. They put me on U.S. Airways. I get here, and they cancel the second flight, which was to go from – I get to L.A. on U.S. Air. They canceled the second flight, which is to take me up here, and they assured me that all the other flights to San Francisco were canceled and there's no other way of getting here. I put on my my hurt, dejected, lost soul facade, which wasn't that much of a facade at the time, and it didn't work. And I put on my annoying, demanding, obnoxious thing, and I got here. So whatever that means. Of course, when I got here, my son was supposed to pick me up. He lives in San Francisco. And as it turns out, as he's about to leave, he found out as he walked out the door that the parade route for the torch was going past his house. And nobody knew that. They diverted. I don't know if you saw the news today, but they tricked all the people in San Francisco. So nobody knew that the route was going past my son's house and he had to come to pick me up here. So anyway, I'm here, and I hope that's the most challenging thing I have to deal with. I want to start off with a little bit of humor, which I usually do, or at least what I think is humor, to try to get you people into the mode of dealing with a serious subject. Does that make sense? Okay. A psychologist walks into a San Francisco bar with a frog on his shoulder. The bartender says, "Where did you get that ridiculous-looking thing?" The frog says, "Stanford Court Hotel, American College of Forensic Psychology. There's at least 100 of them." All right. Okay, anyway, I'll stick to the serious stuff. How many of you have seen the television show To Catch a Predator? Almost everybody. Is there anyone here who has never seen To Catch a Predator? Okay, let me just give you a little brief description then for the sake of about a third of you who have never seen it. What happens is there are men who are chatting on the internet with undercover agents who believe that they're chatting with an underage child, with a child. These men, through the dialogues on the chat rooms, eventually show up to the place where they think they're meeting this underage person. When they show up, they are very quickly confronted by the TV personality and then ultimately by the police. And these people are all then prosecuted. The show became very popular, some of the highest ratings ever for the show, and a lot of people watching the show formed their opinions of these individuals that were showing up, and almost unanimously from what you hear about on in the news media and from other shows is, you know, how society is finally being rid of these dangerous individuals. However, John and I have been working with dozens of individuals over the years who have been caught up in these situations. Both through the evaluation and the treatment of these individuals, we have come to understand that not everyone who shows up in that kind of a scenario where they have been chatting with an underage person and show up, not every one of those individuals, in our opinion, would necessarily be a dangerous predator. Not every one of them would necessarily be somebody who would have acted on what they said they were going to do in their chats. So our presentation today is based on the findings of the work that we've been doing and some of the research that is being done on the mindset of individuals who show up in these kinds of situations. The problem with the way that the prosecutor or the police department or most often the judge looks at this is that a single behavior or sequence of behaviors is being used to explain the intentions of that individual, and it's also being used to explain future behavior. So it's like A plus B equals C. The person is saying on the chats that they plan on having sex with this child or with this individual's children, and they show up at the house. So it's a foregone conclusion, therefore, that this person, if they weren't apprehended, would actually be having sex with that child. And in most cases, that is probably a fair assumption to make. The point of our presentation is that not necessarily in all cases is that a fair assumption to make. What we have to be able to do is just look at the individual and understand why he would be engaging in those chats. And there are a lot of explanations for that, and John is going to be specifically addressing that in a little while. But then we also have to look at the individual who actually shows up. You know, at the point where they're showing up, could there be anything else in their mind besides having sex with that underage individual? And the answer is, it's possible. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand what the actual intent is of the men who walk into that home. The earlier online behavior certainly suggests that their intention would be to have sex with the child. However, if anybody's ever watched the show, some of these individuals that show up are a little bit more sympathetic than others. Would you agree? That if we watch them, they don't form a very homogeneous group. What we see is a group of people, some of whom we feel sorry for, and some of whom we want to wring their necks. So even on that very subjective reaction, that transferential reaction or counter-transferential reaction that we have to observing these poor souls, there's a distinction that we make subjectively that they're not all there coming from the same place. They're all charged with the same crimes, and I'm not sure what kinds of defenses are put forward, but it's not going to make much difference in most of these cases because their chats were very clearly giving evidence of their intent. My concern is that the net that is being thrown out by law enforcement is catching too many people, that the amount of time and money that's being spent on catching these predators may be doing the public a service in the sense that some dangerous people are being taken off the streets. But at the same time, I think too many people who are not dangerous are being caught up in that net. So my concern is that there is a misinterpretation of online sexual behavior by the legal system that fails to distinguish between true pedophiles, true predators, and people who are spending their time on the Internet for other reasons. And again, John is going to speak later a little bit about the other reasons. And then later on, if we have time, I'm going to give a couple of case examples of recent interventions, forensic interventions that I've been involved in, where I believe that there were other reasons, other intentions, beside what appeared to be the intention from looking at the chats. Unfortunately, the theoretical framework for understanding the paths which lead to fantasy users, people who are using the Internet for reasons other than being pedophiles, they're engaged in fantasy chats or something other than pedophilia kind of behavior, the framework for understanding those paths are the same as the paths for pedophiles. So what I'm going to do now is show you, and it's in your handout. Now, there's two models in your handout. I'm going to show you the first one, the simpler of the two. John and I are in the process of developing an integrated model that's going to integrate both of these two that are in your handout. And at this point, the first one is more conceptual. The second one is actually more practical in terms of analyzing step by step. This is based on the Fishbane-Adjun theory of reason-action. It's a predictive model in which the balance between affective and normative attributes combined to predict intention, and intention, in turn, then predicts behavior. What I'm going to be doing is taking a look at these three different stages where the real world that the individual occupies and the internet world begin to converge. And it is through this process of looking at what is going on in that individual's life, affectively and in terms of what's going on normatively, that I think we can begin to plan or plot a path that may help us make a distinction between who is really the dangerous predator and who might be doing this, engaged in this for some other reason. Okay, to begin with, I talk about the web world as an escape. And when an individual is going through life events, the affective status would be likely to be one of either anxiety or depression or some combination of both. The person frequently turns to the internet, and many individuals wind up becoming addicted to the chat rooms or the pornography or various aspects of the internet. The normative status has to do at that point with that person's self-image and how susceptible that person is to outside influences. And what we have next is a division of intentions based on the convergence of that affective status and that normative status. The top one, where it says intent 1A, this represents a convergence of these two components, the affective and the normative, which would lead to an increased probability of staying online. 1B would be a divergence, which would lead to a decreased probability of escaping online. In other words, if the person is not as susceptible to what the influences are that are coming from the internet, it's very likely to lead to behavior 1B, that they're not going to use the internet and these sexual chat rooms as an escape from their anxiety and their depression. But if there's a convergence, if they find that their anxiety and their depression and whatever their emotional state is and what is being considered to be the norm for the groups that they're involved in or chatting with, if these things do converge, it's possible that the escape online will become something that is more likely to continue. Now we talk about the real world and the web world colliding. And in this case, the affective status could be that the person has increased anxiety. There's some confusion now between fantasy and reality. And in the normative status, there is an invitation to this person to come into this world further. They begin to see that more and more people are engaged in this kind of behavior, and the more people that seem to be sharing these kinds of thoughts and interests, the more this person begins to consider, well, this isn't so strange. This isn't so illegal. This isn't so unconventional. And again, if there is a convergence, then again, there'll be now an increased probability of taking this online chat behavior further to the point where the person may even show up to actually see what's going on at that house where that underage individual might be. The divergence at this point has to do with the fact that they're not completely taken in by this normalization process of the web. That what they're hearing and seeing is ego-dystonic, is creating more anxiety for them, and is making them feel like this is not the world that I want to be inhabiting. And that person they may engage in chats, but the likelihood of them showing up is going to decrease. Now we're at the point where we really begin this problem of to catch a predator. We see all these different people actually showing up. Now, these are people that have already made the decision, consciously or unconsciously, to engage in these sexual chats. These are people who have wound up continuing this process to the point where they wind up deciding that they're going to see what's going on there. Now, all of these people are arrested. All of them are charged with the same offenses. And the question that we have here is, how many of these people would actually, if they weren't arrested, get involved in some sexual activity with a child? So again, at this point, we look at the two examples of affective status. The top one would be excitement. This is generating excitement. This is making them feel more intrigued. They want to know more. Skipping down to the bottom one, where it would be divergent, anxiety, panic. What am I doing here? What am I, crazy? And how do I get out of here? And the normative status for the people who are more likely to act in this sexual realm would be, yeah, these have become my norms. Not that they think this way. I mean, not that it's a conscious awareness, but it turns out that there's an incorporation and acceptance of the norms that people not only talk to underage kids or talk to parents about having sex with their underage kids, but they do it. And this person is more likely to form the intent to act and to eventually act. But the divergent one, of course, in this case, would be, these aren't my norms. What am I doing here? I'm not somebody who would have sex with a child. And in that case, where there is a divergence, the likelihood of acting decreases dramatically. So what we have at the top, if we go through that, if you could take it back to the whole chart, what we have here is a pathway where at each step, it has to go in the direction of convergence between the affective and the normative in order for that person to actually have sex with the kid. And it is certainly possible that most of the people that engage in chats aren't going to wind up getting to this last stage. But it's also possible that the ones who do get to the last stage are not going to act. How we make that distinction requires us to understand that there are these choices, there are these junctures, that there are areas that need to be explored in our forensic evaluations to find out how that person wound up being there. Some of this involves understanding why the person would be engaging in these chats to begin with and why they're preoccupied and compulsively using the Internet in that way. And John's going to begin to address some of this.
Maybe I'll address a little of it. As Elliot said, this is not a homogeneous group. It's very heterogeneous. And just like all sex offenders and all different types of rapists and all different types of pedophilic behavior, there's not one profile like the school shooter. There's not one profile that you can look at all the Internet predators and say they're all the same or predict everyone's behavior based on certain conditions that you find. And certainly we're not condoning their behavior at all, but as forensic evaluators, it behooves us to try to separate out different dynamics within what seemingly look like the same behaviors, especially like that on the To Catch a Predator situation. What we looked at is, and what we did was we just broke this down and made it a little more plausible as far as a developmental stage. No one wakes up one morning and just says, hey, I think I'm going to go to the Internet and try to have sex with an adolescent today. I mean, you just don't do that. This is a developmental process. It's just like serial killers. They don't wake up one morning and say, I think I'll go kill 3 or more people today and see what that gets me, see if that makes me feel good. But as Elliot said, we all try to do things to make ourselves feel better when things are going wrong. These people feel insignificant. They mostly feel, except for your narcissist determined person, and I'll get to that in a minute, but most of them feel very insignificant. They feel like the world is not where they want to be. And what do? When you feel badly, what do? Do you fantasize? Is anybody fantasizing here? What do you fantasize about? Don't answer that. But what do you fantasize about? Whatever it does, if you do it over and over and over again, it's probably because it makes you feel good. And these guys usually, I mean, there are things that are happening to them in their stress, biological situation. I'm not going to go through all these, but you know these, the hormones, the neurotransmitters that occur, the error signals that say, I'm in trouble. There's something wrong in my life, whether it's a bad marriage, whether it's my job is falling apart, my family's falling apart, whatever it is. To the outside person, they may not even see that, but the person inwardly feels that. There's affective reactions in which they're lonely and depressed. And then there's the behavior, and what do? They usually try things first. They try several things. Maybe it's some of my guys. I've had 21 people over the past 15 years, and they try a variety of other ways to make themselves feel better. So it could be gambling. Of course, we live in Atlantic City area, so that's easy to do. But that doesn't do it for them. They choose, and then some of them choose chatting, and they're made a social connection. For some of them, it's not the first social connection they've made in their lives, because some of them are married, they have families, and it just destroys their family. But some of them feel empty. They feel that isolation. They feel empty. Even it's the alone in a crowd syndrome, so to speak. But then as they start chatting, they've made a social connection. It's anonymous. They can be anyone they want to be. And they start feeling better. And their anxiety is reduced. And the one person I'm not talking about here at this point is the guy who is a pedophile all the way, has pornography, has made up his mind he's going to have sex with an adolescent. There's very little ego dystonic behavior here. They've made their mind up, and it's just a straightforward path to getting there. It's a hunting ground. It's another tool for them. It's a comfort zone that they feel. It's just another way of picking up children. So I'm not talking particularly about that person within this group. But the person who doesn't know what he's going to do yet, the biological reactions after chatting, well, their anxiety is reduced. They kind of come back to a homeostatic level, both internally and externally. The certain neurotransmitters, as you know, mediate some highs for them, the dopamine situation, and some of the serotonin levels make them feel much better. Their affective reactions as they start developing a relationship, how, although superficial it is, with the object of their choice, they feel that there's a lot of potential attachment, which you and I would go, oh, we're not going to be attached to people we talk to on the Internet. Strangers that we've only met. I mean, they get sexual really fast, as you know, probably. You and I probably are not going to do that. But there's something wrong in their lives that helped them do that. And cognitively, the intensity of the norms that they've learned begin to kind of attenuate. They kind of go down in this area. They feel that they can handle it, that they can do this. And now we're getting into an area. I found that there are several basic types of men who are going to go or going to do this. Not all of them are going to go as and meet the child, as Elliot pointed out. I have, as I said, the determined. I mean, the guy is really going to go do it. Nothing's going to stop him. That's one type. But some of them are very ambivalent, and one of them may actually meet the girl, but he's still not sure he's going to do it. It's fate. He's going to leave it up to fate. I had several guys say, well, I went there, but I didn't really know if I was going to do this or not. I'm ambivalent about it. And you look in their backgrounds, and they treat dates the same way. They've had dates in which they've been big talkers on the phone with people that they've known, but get there personally, and they just melt. So, and I'm sure some of you are saying, well, how do you believe them? How do you know to believe them? And a lot of it is looking at their backgrounds, looking at their characteristics and their backgrounds. So you have some people that will go. They're ambivalent, but they're going to leave it up to fate. You have some that will be on the way. They're on the way. They're driving there. And they go, wow, you know, I could get caught. I think I am going to get caught. I think this is a sting. I really want to have sex with this girl, but I think it's going to be a sting. So they turn around, they drive away. They don't make it to the meeting. They're still arrested, and they're arrested for chatting in sexual ways over the Internet with a minor. But they're not going to get there. And then you have the ones that turn around on the way just because of guilt. I mean, I can't do this to my family. I can't do this to me. They're the real ego dystonic people that are feeling all this guilt and conflict on the way. And as their cognitive reactions develop, then you have some that have absolutely no intention of meeting a person. I have a guy who's very large. He's in his 60s, and he looks like he's in his 60s. you know what I mean. And he tells the girl he's 19. He's never going to meet this woman. He never intended to. He said all he wanted to do was the chat. And he said something very, I was more turned on by the words themselves that I was typing and the words that were being typed back to me than I was the fantasy of the actual sex with the person. And then there's some that state that they just want to go and be near the person. They want to take the person out to dinner. And I think they're high risk, don't get me wrong. But they want to go and they want to take the girl out to a diner. They want to take her to a movie. But they have no fantasies of sexual behavior. And they generally don't have pornography in their background. And you find that they're very immature and socially mature. And generally with those people, you find that there are things that have happened to them when they were 13, 14, 15 years of age. And it's sort of a regression measure. But their biological reactions when they start chatting generally is high. They're affective reactions. They feel good about this. Some of them go into a role-playing mode, and the role-playing is so strong with them, it's almost dissociative in a way. They almost separate themselves. As the one guy was telling me, when I'm chatting, I'm like someone else. I don't know who I am. I'm like on the ceiling watching this guy talk this way to what I know is a 14-year-old girl or a 13-year-old girl. And one guy told me, I know that what I was doing was wrong. I didn't want to do it, but I didn't want to displease this other person either. I'd already started it. I shouldn't have started it, but I didn't want to displease her. She's wanting to meet me. She keeps saying, meet me over here, which comes up to a question and a challenge as far as law enforcement. I'm not knocking law enforcement. I was a cop for 15 years. But sometimes with a fragile ego like this, if the law enforcement officer on the other end had not pushed so hard, that the person probably would have never met. Now, it doesn't excuse this behavior. I'm just talking about a fragile ego here. Other cognitive reactions that occur is I can stop this anytime. I don't have to meet the person. I want to, but I don't have to meet this person. I can stop anytime that I want to. The behavior becomes very much of a role-playing, and I already talked about how they want to actually please the other person. But the big thing here is the cognitive aspects along with the affective is that suddenly the whole world is being blurred. The real world and the web world is blurred, and that may be difficult for you to understand unless you have some kind of an addiction or something. But then after a while, the web world wants to take over the real world, and the person will go ahead and meet that person. And all these things that we talked about earlier with the... I think there's a form of derealization there for a lot of these guys. There's an overwhelming drive to meet this person. And yes, for some, it ostensibly will be for sex and whatever. If you look at what we did also was we looked at the, I got about one more minute. We looked at the chart, 10 more minutes, sorry. Oh, well, that way.
By the way,
did I tell you what happened to me on the way here? Oh, no. What we did was we also assimilated Dr. Elliott's chart that he got. We elaborated on it, and you have it in your packet there. It's the real big, busy one. The chart that's kind of follows along with the PowerPoint more than the first chart you saw. And there's an end part, and look at the very end. And there's choices that this person can make, and those choices are going to be determined by all the steps that they went through before they got to that point. I mean, they can just stop chatting. We've had people just stop chatting, period. They still get arrested, but they just stopped chatting. They had no intentions of meeting. They didn't want to meet, didn't start driving out there. You have people who will go to meet, but then they'll stop, and then you have the people that will actually go out there and meet for sex, and you have some that will go out there and meet possibly not for sex, not for sexual reasons. And we all know that we've had situations where we've had clients that just want someone. They want a connection. Unfortunately, they're picking these 13, 14, 15-year-old girls for these connections. And that's, and sometimes boys. It's not all heterosexual. Sometimes it's boys. Okay. I guess we'll leave it open for questions.
I've got a few more comments before the questions.
Dr. Elliott, this.
We have 10 minutes, including questions. Including questions? Oh, okay. Just in every one of these cases, I always make sure I read not only the chats, get transcripts of the chats that the police have, but also try to get the contents of their computer so we can see what other kinds of activities and interactions they've been having and to see whether it's consistent with this fantasy world versus an interest in children. If the rest of their computer is filled with child pornography, it would be very difficult for us to assume that there was anything other than an interest in sex with the child, although it still could be. It still could be. But there are ways of distinguishing by analyzing the chats. There are ways of distinguishing, and these aren't scientific, but they're more patterns, ways of distinguishing between a true pedophile who's out there trolling for a child and a person who's using the Internet for these fantasy purposes or seeking intimacy. For example, a pedophile who's out there looking for somebody can quickly identify the fact that it's an adult that's playing the role of a child. And if that's the case, they don't want to have sex with the adult. They're not going to be interested in that. A lot of the people who are involved in this for the fantasy purposes don't care if it's an adult playing the role of a child. They're interested in the game. They're interested in the process. So that if we see that, you know, the person is winding up going down this pathway very often with the undercover agent, a true pedophile very often will be off that bandwagon much earlier on in the game. And the other observation that I've seen in my own work and also in the literature is that a pedophile would try to develop a trusting relationship with the object. They would spend time grooming and seducing and trying to build a trusting relationship. They would try to have a bond, a special bond. And that kind of attention that the pedophile gives to the object is very different than the kind of attention that these fantasy users would be giving. The fantasy users, if they get another phone call or another email, say, I'll be right back, or, you know, I'll get back to you later. Or when they get back on, they don't remember what they were talking about. They're more interested in that sex dialogue than building this trusting bond that the pedophile is trying to establish. So through the analysis of these chats themselves and the context based on an analysis of the computer, we can learn a great deal more in addition to what we do by studying the individual and the pathology, the stress levels they were going through, the events, the environmental events they were going through. So if there are any questions, John and I will probably only have a couple minutes. Could you come up to the mic?
Yeah, I'm wondering whether you think that some of the same, I'll use the word dynamics or factors, apply with respect to possession of child pornography. I've done a number of cases in which people have amassed large collections of child pornography. The assumption of oftentimes on the part of the police and the judiciary is that if you have child pornography, then you're a pedophile. And I've seen so many cases in which that isn't true. The individual may be, like some of these chatters, very inadequate, often very limited social and sexual experience. They amass the pornography for all sorts of reasons, sometimes to collect in obsessive-compulsive ways, sometimes as an antidote to depression, sometimes because they're not good at anything else.
I'm glad you give them
an identity and a status.
I'm glad you brought that up because this whole thing applies almost exactly. It could be superimposed on that problem. And it's funny, we're sitting here this morning, John and I were talking about this exact issue. I said to him, I've got this case where this person was viewing 13-year-olds when he was 13, 14 and 15-year-olds when he was 14 and 15, 16-year-olds when he was 16, and when he turned 18, the federal government finally came in and arrested him and charged him with possession and distribution of child pornography, and he's facing 7 years after pleading guilty, 7 years in federal prison. And John, it turned out he was the one who referred me the case. We didn't even realize that there was that connection. Because he said, yeah, I had a similar case. This was a kid who had no other life. He was being homeschooled, had no friends, And his whole way of interacting with the world was through the chats of the internet. And of course, this developed an interest in child pornography. He started accumulating the child pornography and exchanging it, but it was the children that were his age that he was exchanging. So is this a pedophile? Now that, you know, he pled guilty and he's going to jail and he's going to be in Megan's Law.
Well, the other thing I found oftentimes in some of these individuals is undisclosed and untreated histories of sexual abuse. If, say, you have an adult male who's viewing homosexual child pornography, I've often found childhood sexual abuse in their backgrounds that's been untreated. And I have sort of a dynamic orientation and see these things very much as fixations. And I liked your use of the word regressions in a lot of times, and people are trying in a very maladaptive way to work through particular kinds of trauma in the absence of any treatment.
Yeah, we see that all the time. Okay. One of the other quick examples, if we have another minute, that John and I were talking about this morning, is the cafeteria style of pornography collecting. I had a case where the guy was caught with a couple hundred images of child pornography, but when we looked at his computer contents, they represented about 5% of the pornography that he had. He had necrophilia, coprophilia, urophilia. He had every possible kind of thing. And the child pornography was about 5 or 10% of this overall cafeteria style of trying to learn about every possible kind of perversion.
So we'd have to call him a necrophile, a coprophile, a pedophile. There is a term for that, I guess you know. It's pansexual. It's sexually attracted to just about everything there is.
But he wasn't breaking the law with looking at those images. Only with looking at the child pornography was he breaking the law.
Yeah, you don't break the law when you look at people having sex with dead bodies.
Or dead dogs.
Or dead dogs. Or dead deer. On that note, thank you very much.
I don't know how to do it. I hate to usually.